traveler sits at the center of a tangled mess of wires, switches, power packs, and flickering lights. Outside, insects buzz as the sun creeps up through the clear morning sky. The helmeted stranger checks the readouts from the dials arrayed around them, confirming the hermetic seal between the pod and the environment outside. Already, they start to feel the cool, recycled air circulating through the cramped space, a welcome relief from the stifle of the Australian summer beyond their capsule. Testing the controls in front of them, they push the levers back and forwards. Everything seems to be working. And on the screen before them is confirmed the most important readings of all. The current date and time and their target year, 4.5 billion years ago. When this young adventurer had first stepped into the pod, they hadn't even been sure the computer would accept a target date so far in the past, for they are not an explorer or a historian, but a paleontologist. Having spent their life studying the history of the Earth, reading the rocks and fossils, and imagining bygone worlds, the time machines finally offered an opportunity to see them with their own eyes, to experience the air, the ocean, and the life forms firsthand. And this paleontologist wants to see it all, starting from the very beginning. By starting out here, in the humid Western Australian air, they reason that they have the best chance of finding solid ground at their destination, since these rocks are some of the oldest in the world. Flicking switches to begin the boot-up sequence, they double-check the target date once again. 4.5 billion years should take them right to the beginning of our planet's story. And what better vantage point from which to view the entire history of the Earth? And so finally, with all indicators in the green and their heart beating hard in their chest, their journey begins with the final push of a big red mechanical button. Through the curved glass windows in front of them, they see the bright disk of the sun, which had almost reached its zenith, now begin to slink down towards the horizon, retracing its path. It moves slowly at first, but as they watch, its descent accelerates, and all too soon, the sky is darkening in a blue reverse dawn. Then it is night, and the stars wheel backwards through the desert sky before fading in a rapid dusk and orange sunset. This time, the previous day, the sun barrels across the sky, barely even leaving a mark on the time traveler's retinas. Night follows day with increasing rapidity until the days and nights themselves blur into a singular bluish-grey haze. The current date on their screen scrolls back, first by months, then years, as the scenery begins to shift. Trees shrink back to the ground, rocky outcrops grow and reassemble as the years turn to decades, centuries, millennia. When millions of years are ticking by with every passing second, even the landscape becomes a blur. And suddenly, in the darkness, for the first time, a seed of doubt takes root. In their determination to see this journey through, to satisfy their curiosity, have they perhaps rushed in too fast? Have they properly considered the risks? Were they properly prepared? Will they, and the layers of metal and glass that stand between them and the hurtling gulf of time, even be able to survive on the early Earth? Indeed, when would they even find an era in which they'd be able to remain? But it is too late. Already, the time machine is sounding its warnings that the target date is approaching. The passage of millennia and centuries slows. There is now no choice but to look out and face the past. The universe is a few hundred million years old. Vast clouds of hydrogen and helium gas created just a few minutes after the Big Bang draw together into clumps that are dense enough at their hearts for nuclear fusion to begin. For the first time, stellar nurseries grow to become globular star clusters, which themselves draw together and begin to rotate, flattening into a disk and drawing out the characteristically curving arms of a spiral galaxy. And thus, our Milky Way galaxy is born. By 5 billion years ago, many generations of stars have already lived and died, and the initial flurry of new starbirths within the galaxy has tailed off to a trickle. And yet, in a fragmented curving arm 25,000 light-years from the galactic center, one such latecomer sputters into life in the heart of a nebula filled with the heavy elemental shrapnel from other long-distance stars. The new star soon grows to a modest-sized orange-yellow sun, surrounded, like the entire galaxy writ in miniature, by a swirling disk of gas and dust. As gravity draws the particles within that disk together, they grow to pebbles, to boulders, and eventually to rocky, icy, and gassy worlds that continue their unruly wheeling rotations. For a time, chaos reigns among these newborn worlds as they jostle orbits, grappling for dominance among the clutter of planetary detritus. And so it remains for as much as 100 million years before the victors emerge. Rocky worlds, scarred, glowing, oozing, but rotating freely and uncontested. And in the third such orbit, positioned about 150 million kilometers away from the young sun, is a rocky world that will eventually change its face entirely and become host to the most precious of all cosmological creations. And so, as the time machine decelerates to a stop, the traveler opens their eyes onto the Hadean Earth, to find it every bit as hellish as its namesake. Where the sky before had been a blurred grey blend of blue day and starlit night, now day and night is not so clear. The heavens remain dim even when the yellow sun sears its slowing line across the sky. There is much less atmosphere to disperse and diffract the sunlight, and the traveler is thankful for the strong rubber seals that hold the pressure of air inside against the vacuous deficiency beyond. There is atmosphere out there, but it is a thin layer of hydrogen and helium, and the faint blue tinge to the unclouded sky is offset by an orange glow from the dark ground itself. A cacophony of alarms begin to sound inside the capsule. Warnings of unstable ground, high temperatures, shuddering impacts. It is clear that this far back, so close to Earth's creation, the planet is far from hospitable. Its glassy, black, volcanic surface is thin enough to be easily broken by upswelling bubbles of magma and is shattered into a chaotic, molten plain as far as the eye can see. Everything is sharp and angular. There is no water or air substantial enough to round out boulders, and the constantly shifting surface breaks and fuses broken basalt anew. And in the sky, there are hints of another agent of destruction as well, as meteors streak their fiery lines across the dim dome. Most explode or burn out before reaching the surface, but others, mercifully distant from the traveler's pod, splash down into the rock and magma, sending a spray of orange liquid and clattering rocks. Adrenaline and fear are finally enough to overcome curiosity as the alarms ramp up their pitch and urgency. Frantically dialing in a new target date, the traveler punches the start button with a balled fist not a moment too soon. Suspended in a safe bubble of time dilation, the pod is unaffected as the scorching ground opens up beneath it. As it speeds forward in time, the machine now bears the melted and charred scars of its close encounter, and the paleontologist breathes a sigh of relief. In retrospect, perhaps jumping headlong into the late heavy bombardment hadn't been the best of ideas. When the time machine slows again, approaching the new date of 3.5 billion BCE, it is as if it is arriving on an entirely different planet. Where before the sky had been dim and star-studded even in the day, it is now hazy blue, even orange in parts. White and grey clouds of every shape and size build fortresses high in the atmosphere. Where before the land had been a broken and shattered firmament of rock and magma, there is now a smoothly rippled expanse of deep blue water. The capsule bobs gently with each passing wave. But this is the Earth. The Archean Earth, some billion years after the chaos of planetary formation, and in that short time, the true habitability of the third rock from our sun has already begun to be realized. The Earth occupies a privileged place within the solar system, positioned not so close to the fires of its star that water evaporates away, and not so far away that it freezes into impenetrable ice. Only here, in our thin orbital band, is it possible for these oceans to exist. But something doesn't quite add up. The Sun is still barely more than 1,000 million years old and has not yet matured and come into its full luminosity. Its light shines only 3/4 as brightly and as warmly as it will in modern times, and so the temperature on the planet's surface shouldn't be quite this clement. There should be icebergs and a distinct chill in the air, but the capsule's instruments actually register a temperature around 30 degrees Celsius, not so different from the tropical heat our traveler left behind in Australia. But why? The solution to this climatic conundrum is to be found in the hazy sky above. After their close call in the Hadean, the traveler is not taking any chances, and rather than daring to venture out, they make use of the onboard instruments to measure everything they can about the air and water beyond the pod. The water turns out to be a very pleasant temperature for swimming, but is slightly more acidic than the oceans of the modern era. Nothing so strong as to burn the skin, but with a pH akin to that of orange juice, it is drinkable. The agent of this acidity is carbonic acid, the same substance that is causing reef-killing acidification in the modern oceans. And the carbonic acid in the Archean seas, while not yet having any reefs or really any life at all to jeopardize, actually has the same origin. Gases in the atmosphere. The sky above the endless blue expanse doesn't look too different from the skies of the modern Earth. The towering clouds are built from water vapor, drawn from and cycling endlessly with the great oceanic expanse. Meanwhile, the density of air molecules within 100 kilometers of the surface serve to scatter the blue wavelengths of the sun's white light, turning the entire daytime sky blue. But the makeup of these air molecules is where the difference lies. Once again, the traveler can be thankful for the hermetic seal on the time machine, because without it, they would immediately suffocate in the Archean air. There is none of the oxygen their body needs to survive, only nitrogen, carbon dioxide, and methane. Though like today, relatively inert nitrogen makes up the bulk of the atmosphere, carbon-bearing molecules fill the gap left by the absence of oxygen, making up some 10 to 15% of the air. And it is these that are responsible for many of the curious phenomena that beset this Archean world. Firstly, the carbon dioxide is the source of the ocean's acidity. Carbon dioxide gas becomes carbonic acid in the water, raising the pH and speeding up the chemical erosion of the exposed ocean floor. These carbon-rich molecules are also the source of the otherworldly haze that tints the upper skies with a pale orange hue. When light from the sun strikes the methane, carbon dioxide, and nitrogen molecules at the top of the atmosphere, it begins a chain of chemical reactions that produces larger carbon-bearing organic molecules with greater capacity for scattering light. This organic haze is similar to that which shrouds Saturn's moon Titan today, although on the early Earth it is much thinner and more diffuse, allowing more of the sun's weak light to penetrate. And considering that weak light, it is also the carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere that solves this apparent paradox of a tropical climate in spite of the faint young sun. Both of these carbon-rich molecules are powerful greenhouse gases, able to trap the infrared radiation that bounces from the Earth, keeping it close to the surface and swaddling the planet in an insulating layer of heat. Much higher concentrations of greenhouse gases lead to more heat being trapped, despite the fact that less heat is being delivered in the first place. And so, this balmy ocean and its humid, hazy sky really owe their existence to the invisible molecules in the Archean air. A part of the traveler longs to dip their toes in the warm waters that lap against the capsule's windows, but without any breathing aid, they cannot risk cracking the seal that is keeping them safe. And so they sit and watch calmly as the sun sinks redly below the flat horizon, and the sky fills with stars. The orange, hazy glow of daytime is replaced with dramatic curtains of light as the aurora drapes itself over these southern latitudes. Unlike the green-tinted southern lights of the modern day, these auroras are predominantly blue and red, another reminder of the nitrogen-rich, oxygen-poor atmosphere beyond. All around the capsule, there is no land in sight, despite this being the period in which the most ancient rocks of Western Australia formed, because, of course, they are forming at the bottom of the ocean, from sand and mud grains eroded from the seafloor itself. This is a time before land, before continents, and it will be a billion years or more until the rocks that are forming now eventually see these stars. The endless ocean, the dark, empty depths, and the crushing pressure of an unbreathable atmosphere weigh heavily on the traveller. At the very least, they will need to find an atmosphere they can breathe. And although life is making a burgeoning beginning at the bottom of the dark ocean, it is still a bit player on the planetary stage. They cannot stay here. On the 18th of February 2021, after an interplanetary journey of some 480 million kilometers, the Perseverance rover touched down on the surface of Mars. The descent and landing had been nail-biting for the hundreds of scientists and engineers involved in its development, as the spacecraft deployed parachutes, reverse jets, and eventually a hovering crane to decelerate the car-sized rover from a cruising speed of nearly 40,000 kilometers per hour to deliver the rover safely and slowly to the ground. All of these interventions were necessary because Mars has just 1% of the atmosphere that Earth does, so the spacecraft couldn't rely on the air itself to slow it down. But after 7 long minutes, in which the landing sequence unfolded automatically as planned, Perseverance did touch down in one functioning piece to begin its operations on the Martian surface. Generations of Mars rovers have now been sent to the Red Planet to study it, trace its geological history, and prepare for future manned and returning missions. Both future colonists and returning spacecraft will need certain resources already there when they arrive, chief among them being oxygen for breathing and for rocket fuel. But Mars has little oxygen of its own. Its thin atmosphere naturally contains less than a sixth of a percent of the critical gas. And so the Perseverance rover carried an experimental instrument on board called the Mars Oxygen In Situ Resource Utilization Experiment, shortened to MOXIE, which was designed to test a new technology for making the oxygen future missions would need. This technology works by taking the more abundant carbon dioxide from the Martian air and using exotic mineral catalysts and temperatures around 800 degrees Celsius to split the molecule into its component parts: oxygen, which can be trapped and stored, and carbon monoxide, that's released back into the air. And in April 2021, after just a few months on the planet's surface, MOXIE succeeded in its task. Over the course of around 1 hour, the instrument made 5.3 grams of oxygen, literally from thin air. This is about the same production as you might get from a modest-sized tree, and is enough to supply an astronaut with breathable air for about 10 minutes. Clearly, improvements need to be made as the technology is scaled up in order for it to be sustainable. But nonetheless, scientists celebrated their success as a first step towards long-term, manned Mars missions. As impressive as this first feat of terraforming is, it is ultimately a pale imitation of a process that is happening all over the Earth, every minute of every day, and which was first mastered by microbes at least 2.4 billion years ago. Considering their next temporal jump, our traveller recalls that one of the major transitions in the evolution of life on Earth happened around 2.5 billion years ago. This is the Paleoproterozoic, and a period of Earth's history known grandly as the Great Oxidation Event. And so the traveller finishes the calculations, starts the machine, and makes the leap. Prior to this time, microbial life had evolved and colonized the deeper oceans, surviving off the chemical energy in certain inorganic minerals, as well as the heat emitted from submarine volcanic vents. And they did very well there, constructing layered microbial metropolises with separate castes of life, utilizing successive byproducts from these early metabolisms. But their colonization ultimately met a dead end, even a few meters away from the sources of such energy. These chemotropic microbes would be forever confined to the few, disparate parts of the deep ocean with the energy to sustain them, while the rest of the planet remained barren and uninhabited. That was until a revolution in microbial metabolism changed the way things could be done. Instead of deriving energy from heat, the appearance of certain pigment molecules allowed microbes to use the energy from the sun. And to accompany this bottomless feast of energy, these innovative life forms turned to the abundance of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and water in the ocean to provide the raw nutrition for metabolism and growth. Whether in a single evolutionary flash of brilliance, or, as is more likely, a few million years of stumbling stepwise innovation, photosynthesis was invented. Captured sunlight splits carbon dioxide and water molecules, which are then reassembled into energy-storing sugars and oxygen as a byproduct. The sugars help the photosynthesizing microbe survive, while the oxygen is released as waste, back into the ocean and atmosphere. Paleontologists cannot be sure exactly when this metabolic revolution occurred. Tracing the gene evolution of modern photosynthesizing microbes called cyanobacteria puts their origin around 2.7 billion years ago, and although some fossils have been recovered from much earlier strata that seem to resemble them, the geological evidence for large-scale oxygen production doesn't seem to appear until the turn of the Proterozoic. And so, photosynthetic metabolisms evolved, which resulted in oxygen being released in great quantity, fundamentally altering the kinds of rocks that were created around this time. But this oxygen was also poisonous to many of the ecosystems that thrived at this time, and so the very process that gave them life also stifled and suffocated them. The earliest years of photosynthesis were therefore stop-start, pulsing and pausing, as ecosystems died off and recovered, causing vast global extinction events, before eventually finding their feet in a new, oxygenated world order. The traveller has their eyes on the atmospheric composition readouts as the time machine arrives at this turning point in Earth's history, and is satisfied to see the percentage of oxygen in the air creep up to 1, 2, 3, 4%. This is a good sign, confirmation of the signals in the rocks that photosynthesis has arrived on the scene and has begun to transform the atmosphere with its waste product. But at 4%, it stalls, unchanging, not rising any higher. This, they quickly realize, won't be enough to breathe. For that, they will need at least 10% oxygen, and preferably much more. Frustrated, they finally tear their eyes away from the dashboard to the windows, and are surprised to once again see a world completely transformed. For beyond the metallic pod, it is white as far as the eye can see. Landforms are laid out before them, foothills rise to mountains in the distance, and a flat expanse that could be an ocean stretches out over to one side. But it is all white, covered in ice and snow, with just the occasional rocky bluff showing through where it's been swept clean by the wind. Already, ice crystals begin to grow around the edges of the window glass. The traveller will not be able to see from their singular viewpoint, but this icy terrain extends around much of the globe. From the poles to the tropics, ocean surfaces are frozen solid, rivers iced over, and snow is blown into towering drifts that are also frozen in place. They have jumped into the near-global Huronian glaciation, which gripped the planet for some 300 million years following the Great Oxygenation Event. Photosynthesizing organisms colonizing the shallow seas of the Paleoproterozoic drew in carbon dioxide, reducing its concentration in the atmosphere. Meanwhile, the oxygen emitted reacted with the methane in the air, turning it into carbon dioxide and water that also became fuel for photosynthesis. With this new microbial metabolism, the two powerful greenhouse gases that were holding in heat and insulating the planet against a faint young sun became suddenly depleted, and the Earth was left, quite literally, out in the cold. And so the traveller has found the origins of photosynthesis and the beginning of atmospheric oxygen, but it isn't enough. There is still not enough of the gas to breathe, and the balmy tropical waters that had been so inviting are now a thing of the past. They simply have no choice but to keep moving forward in time to try and find when the world becomes hospitable once again. This time, now accustomed to the dizzying acceleration and deceleration in time, they try a new approach to piloting the temporal expanse. Instead of selecting a target date for the machine to reach, they switch the controls into manual and ease the lever forwards. As before, the days and nights blend together, and the sun blurs into a streak that sways back and forth across the sky with the seasons. But the land remains white around them. Global glaciations like these are not easily shifted, and they see the millennia tick by with scarcely any change. It's only around 2.2 billion years ago that the colour returns to the world, and the traveller watches red-tinged landscape around them grow with mountain building, smooth out and shrink back with weathering and erosion. The temperatures are more clement, but the oxygen fails to rise any further. It is resolutely stuck at 4%. As the date ticks past 1.6 billion BCE, the traveller passes notionally into the Mesoproterozoic, but there is little change to show for it. This entire era languishes within a period of Earth's history known as the Boring Billion, and even with this temporally averaged view, it is clear how it earned its name. For about a billion years, between 1.8 and 0.8 billion years ago, very little changes at all. The landscape undulates around the capsule, the shorelines creep forward and back, but there are no dramatic flashes of ice age, catastrophic stormy seasons, or bursts of photosynthetic green. If anything, the world looks less inviting with each passing moment. The seas are a blackish-purple colour, testament to their ongoing general lack of oxygen and the chemosynthetic microbes that are able to colonise them. The atmospheric readings point to elevated levels of hydrogen sulfide in the coastal air as well, and the paleontologist hopes their mind is playing tricks on them as they think they detect a faint whiff of rotten eggs. But things cannot stay like this forever. They know that, beneath the calm, unchanging surface of the Boring Billion, there is a frenzy of evolutionary activity. The stability of these millennia is allowing microbes to experiment with new means of getting energy and new, cooperative ways of life. Eager to see the fruits of these evolutionary labours, they push the lever forward to its furthest reach and press onwards to the Neoproterozoic. In many ways, the modern landscape of the northwest of Scotland is reminiscent of the same location some billions of years earlier. The notched shorelines and inland lochs are rimmed with rocky outcrops that slope gently into the calmly lapping waters, eroding slowly into fine sand and mud that sinks to the lake bottom, just as it did in the Neoproterozoic. Looking past the modern-day heather and stunted trees, the shorelines are washed with rubbery seaweeds that belong to more primitive algal families. but if you scrape back those living algae and expose the ancient rocks beneath, you will find ripples frozen into the fine-grained sediment, adorned with lace-like patterns of tufts, wrinkles, and pustules. These are the delicate traces left by algal mats that grew and colonized the shoreline a billion years ago, a sign that photosynthetic life had taken the next step onto the land and into the light. Halfway around the globe and 1,000 million years in the past, the traveler witnesses this change in the ecosystem firsthand. Even though there has been life in the oceans for nigh on 2.5 billion years, this is the first time that it becomes visible to the naked eye. Around the edges of the oceans, now returned to a healthier grey-blue that reflects the sky, there is an unmistakable tinge of green. The photosynthesizing organisms in the water are still largely microscopic, but they are present in such number that they cannot be missed. The retreating tide leaves behind a scum of frothy green microbes, buoyed by the air trapped beneath their interlocking fibers, and a quick glance at the atmospheric readings confirms what the color change suggests. Photosynthesis is now so well established in the surface oceans, and its carbon dioxide drawdown and oxygen production so efficient, that the oxygen concentration in the atmosphere has finally risen after around 1.5 billion years of frustrating stasis. Now, in the year 750 million BCE, oxygen levels have jumped to a little less than 20% of the entire atmospheric composition. And for the first time in their journey, the fragile human traveler will be able to breathe the ancient air beyond the capsule. They waste no time. With a final check that confirms the temperature is safe and that there are no toxic surprises lurking beyond the machine's warping glass, they crank the handle to break the seals. A faint hiss as the pressure equilibrates, and their nose is suffused with the smells of the neoproterozoic air. After the cool, sterile, but increasingly stuffy microcosm inside the capsule, the sensation is one of stepping off a plane on some tropical isle. There is humidity, warmth, and the vague aroma of salt and decay drifting up from the beach. Breathing deeply, the traveler soaks in this ancient air before swinging their legs out and onto the barren, rocky ground. Wanting more than anything to run to the water, explore everything they can see, they hold themselves back. Oxygen concentrations are still not enough to support their muscles under any kind of exertion, so they take it slowly, step by step. They feel a little lightheaded, but that's not just because of the oxygen deficiency. There is also a small but detectable quantity of nitrous oxide, laughing gas, in the air. This nitrous oxide is a consequence of the complex nitrogen chemistry that has been made possible by this new supercharged surge of life, and it is helping to keep the planet warm despite the extra draw on its carbon dioxide reserves. With careful steps, the paleontologist approaches the shore, and reaching the still wet sand, they probe the accumulated organic matter with their boots before scooping it with their hand. It is cool, slimy, and up close appears in a spectrum of hues and textures, from fibrous green filaments and froth to sturdier, rubbery red-tinged structures like seaweed. Without anything to graze upon it, these primitive algae coat the shoreline as it disappears into the distance, drying out and rotting where they sit, and the whole intertidal flat is turned black by the breakdown of such abundant organic matter. A shadow passes across the sun, and for the first time, the traveler looks up from the life on the beach to the dark grey of a developing storm out to sea. The warm temperature over the shallow oceans provide the ideal fuel for evaporation, winds, and violent cyclones that will soon come and inundate this living diorama. Like so many tropical island holidays, the scene can switch all too quickly from calm to cataclysm with the arrival of a single storm. The traveler is suddenly aware of how exposed they are on the open beach, with only the low, undulating dunes and the decaying algae for company. When the storm strikes, there will be no cover or shelter from the deluge, and as they watch the thunderheads grow over the horizon, they don't like to contemplate their, or the time machine's fate in the face of such natural violence. And as if on cue, their stomach rumbles. They are reminded that shelter isn't the only thing they would need in order to extend their trip in the Neoproterozoic. They've lost track of how long they have spent traveling through the expanse of Earth's history, but their body has not. They need to eat. Unfortunately, these slimy, fermenting algae are not only unappetizing, despite sharing biological structure with their modern counterparts, they're likely to be indigestible to the modern human stomach, so offer no real nutrition. If the traveler is going to be able to stay anywhere in the past for any amount of time, they will need to find both food and shelter. With dragging feet and the beginnings of a headache, they reluctantly trudge back up the dunes to the confines of the time machine once again. In 1921, famed Arctic explorer Vilhelm Stefansson organized an ambitious expedition to the remote Wrangel Island off the northeast coast of Siberia, with the goal of claiming the island for Britain. Perhaps it was foreshadowing that Stefansson never intended to be part of the expedition at all, but instead sent four brave but ultimately inexperienced British men, along with a young native Alaskan woman, Ada Blackjack, as cook and seamstress. Ada may have been native to the icy world of Alaska, but she had been brought up a Methodist and knew nothing of the indigenous survival techniques. She was as much a novice in these icy wilds as the men she accompanied. The five managed to last out on the island for almost a year, but the expedition came upon hard times as summer turned to winter. One of the men became gravely ill with scurvy, and the other three elected to leave him and Ada behind in search of better fortunes elsewhere. They were never heard from again. Ada continued to care for the sick and bedridden man alone until his eventual death. But that was not to be her end. Instead, teaching herself many fundamental survival skills, she learned to shoot and trap to produce them with food, built shelter and polar bear lookout platforms with driftwood and storage boxes, and even built herself a boat from animal skins. After the Brit's death, she survived entirely alone on the island for 3 long months, and when a boat eventually arrived in search of the missing expedition, 2 years after it had set out, its crew found only Ada alone in the Arctic wilderness. The time-traveling paleontologist pilots their craft with confidence now, easing through the millennia. As the landscape flashes by, they are left with time to wander, to think about what it is humans really need to survive. The absolute basics. To begin with, we need air we can breathe, and that means oxygen. We need a temperature that our bodies can sustain in, and depending on the humidity and the clothes available to us, that means anything from a few degrees above freezing to perhaps 50 degrees Celsius. We need water to drink to sustain our basic metabolic processes, so that water must be above freezing to be liquid and clean enough to not cause its own raft of problems. We need food to sustain our metabolisms too, including the energy-rich carbohydrates found in grains and vegetables, and the bodybuilding proteins found in pulses and animal flesh. And because nothing in the natural world ever stays the same, we need shelter to protect us, whether that be from violent swings in weather, temperature, or the threat of the living components of the ecosystem. And so, in their travels, it has taken the paleontologist some 4 billion years to get to the temperature, water, and air that are the most critical for immediate survival. But they have yet to find the food and shelter that will allow them to endure. Flickering forward through the second half of the Neoproterozoic, the landscape switches periodically between the colorful hues of a temperate coast and the oppressive monochrome of a glacial world. Just as it was nearly 2 billion years before, these glaciations are global in extent, turning the entire Earth into a featureless icy snowball. But the new abundance and diversity of life in the shallow oceans is able to cling on in slushy warm refugia around the equator and near volcanic hotspots, and it bounces back with gusto at the first hint of warming temperatures. The last of these planet-spanning glaciers fades away, and the traveler slows their craft to a stop. This, they know, is the Ediacaran. The most recently defined period of Earth's history, the Ediacaran was only recognized as an era in its own right in 2004, and so, though it is not immediately apparent on arrival, there is a revolution in animal life taking place. Where before there had only been bacteria and algae, there is now something completely different, which the Earth has never seen before or since. The environment beyond the capsule is once again warm and tropical, and the oxygen levels are even closer to what the traveler's body needs. So they are quick to leave the craft behind on the shore and wade into the shallows, in hope of seeing these remarkable life forms for themselves. The Ediacaran biota has flummoxed geologists for decades. They exist as the first truly macroscopic life, but their preservation as impressions in soft sand, mud, and volcanic ash means that we still don't know much about how their bodies are constructed. Some live in the ocean depths, far from the reach of the sun, and are thought to get their food from the decaying organic matter in the seafloor mud itself. Others can be found in shallower, sandy environments of river deltas, where the sun dapples the seafloor and waves constantly shift the substrate and its bizarre inhabitants. Entering the water up to their knees and kneeling down to peer through the glassy shallows, the paleontologist searches for these curious Ediacarans, like a child might search a rock pool for shrimp. It is not long before they spot their quarry. Flattened Dickinsonia flopping along the sand, Spragina flapping like loose ribbons from their shallow anchors, and shield-shaped Parvancarina squat to the sand, but aligned with the rippling waves. These strange animal-like creatures seem unaware of, or at least unable to react to, the hulking human casting shadows above them, and the paleontologist is easily able to reach out and touch them, running their fingers along their rubbery, quilted flesh. With no skeleton, shell, or really any digestive tract that they could see, there was little preparation needed. After a little boiling in seawater, they had the texture somewhere between oysters and squid. Doubtless, in enough quantity, these Ediacarans could provide the body with the protein it needed to sustain itself, but the knowledge of these creatures' rarity leaves a sour taste in the mouth. The traveler may well be the first eater creature that has been extinct for 500 million years, but they won't be complicit in that extinction. Proper food and shelter should be found closer to home. There is a legend that geological prospector Charles Doolittle Walcott was riding with his family and an expeditionary party along a trail in the Canadian Rockies of British Columbia when his wife's horse stumbled and tripped on a rock, splitting it open in the process. Dismounting, Walcott rushes to the broken rock rather than his wife's aid to find it packed with curious flattened shapes that he recognizes as fossils. The party work their way up the slope to find the source of this bountiful rock and eventually discover a paleontological bounty like nothing anyone had seen before. This so-called Burgess Shale contained organic fossils of a multitude of strange animals, perfectly preserved by their black, muddy internment. Over the next several years, Walcott led parties back to the shale, collecting more than 60,000 specimens of remarkably preserved, soft-bodied animals, all dating to some of the earliest moments of the Cambrian period, and this veritable explosion of animal life. And it is during this eponymous Cambrian explosion, parked up at a date of 500 million years BCE, that the traveler finally finds a seafood feast that carries no guilt. The same seas that had played host to the helpless fleshy Ediacarans that flopped and flapped on the sandy surface now hold an almost unfathomable treasure of swimming, squirming, and burrowing animal life. Shelly brachiopods like clams and cockles cluster among jointed-legged arthropods, including trilobites of every size and shape, plus free-swimming Anomalocaris and Opabinia predators adorned with pincers and prongs. A circus of worms mix up the seafloor sediment, while Hallucigenia probes the disturbed surface, protected from overhead attack by its mohawk of pointed spines. Ely Pekaya squirms through the shallow waters, while many more unfamiliar animal shapes drift close to and above the surface. The paleontologist can eat their fill of this protein-rich banquet and never make a dent in the population as a whole. But protein is only part of the balanced diet that a survivalist needs. Inuits of the modern age make do on an exclusively animal diet by making the most of what those animals have to offer, including their bones, blubber, even gut contents. But these primitive Cambrian animals are more flesh than bone, and their ecosystems too immature for a paleogastronomist to glean much more. Not to mention that these warm, tropical, life-filled oceans are still prone to violent storms from which there is no hope of shelter. And so, forward, still, the traveler must continue. Following the eruption of animal life in the seas during the Cambrian, the next logical step for biology is towards the as yet uncolonized land surfaces. However, this is a process much easier said than done, as bare rock and chemically weathered sands offer little in the way of nutrition or support for burgeoning life. It takes a succession of algae, fungi, lichen, and squat, spreading land plants to brave the elements and build the first soils from the bottom up. And so, it isn't until some 50 million years later, during the Ordovician period, that the time traveler encounters the first life on land capable of casting a shadow. But these are no trees. They're actually a skyscraper of a fungus known as Prototaxites. Smooth and featureless monoliths rise up to 8 meters in height, standing proud and sturdy with trunks that can be 1 meter in diameter. Where decay sees these mighty mushrooms felled, their trunks lie chaotically across the landscape, swathed in smaller plants and swarmed by insects, some of the first animal pioneers to colonize the land. The traveler spends a little time exploring this founder's landscape, and can imagine making use of Prototaxites to build a shelter should the need arise. But with the world transforming so fast around them now, they are keen to see how things change throughout the rest of the Paleozoic and beyond. Ticking away millions of years by the second, it is just a short hop from the Ordovician to the Devonian of 400 million years ago, and then to the Carboniferous of 300 million years BCE. The limited fungal forest is supplanted by a succession of plants and trees, with an ever-broadening diversity of shapes, sizes, and approaches to photosynthesis. The once barren, rocky land surfaces are transformed to a spongy, loamy soil, pierced by coniferous forest as far as the eye can see. Here, for the first time, the trees alone are able to provide shelter from the elements, and walking among their densely crowded trunks, the traveler finds themselves cast in a green-hued gloom from which it is difficult to glimpse the sky. Meanwhile, in the oceans, the bizarre life forms of the Cambrian have also been succeeded by an overwhelming diversity of fish, ancestors of the multitudes that we know of today. The first trees, as well as providing comforting shelter, also provide the traveler-turned-hunter with the tools needed to capture their prey, as they fashion sharpened spears from discarded branches and wade into the shallows to track down a daily catch. It feels like the ultimate wilderness adventure in this Carboniferous world, but it is not a place that can sustain the traveler in the long term. While the ever-increasing diversity of vegetation and animal life offers a much more varied diet than ever before, much of it remains beyond the reach of the human stomach. The trees and plants all belong to a group known as gymnosperms, which reproduce with seeds contained in cones rather than fruits, and as such are of little nutritional value. Despite their impressive size and morphological variety, they are no more digestible than the seaweed scum that rotted on the Neoproterozoic shore. To meet the body's carbohydrate energy needs, the traveler needs to travel one more time. And so now they make their final jump, skipping forward another 180 million years into the future to near the close of the Mesozoic. When paleontologists first discovered the 120 million year old fossil of a raven-sized long-tailed bird called Jaelornis, they saw it surrounded by a scattering of seeds, as if its stomach contents had exploded during its burial and fossilization. The researchers first thought this pointed to a diet that, like many before it, consisted of the seeds commonly produced by conifers and other gymnosperms of the Cretaceous forests. But there was a number of things about Jaelornis that didn't quite add up. In order to get enough nutrition from these tough seeds, birds typically swallow small stones to produce a kind of internal gastric mill that would help to break them down inside the body. But the Jaelornis fossils had no sign of gastric stones, and they didn't have the sort of beak or mouth structures that would allow them to break down the seeds either. How could these large birds get enough nutrients from their diet? The obvious solution lay in what was not being preserved in the fossil record, but which was nevertheless implied by other clues left behind. Jaelornis was not eating seeds on their own, but rather feasted on soft fruit. The nutrition came from the sugary fruiting structures of a newly evolved kind of plant, and the seeds were merely an indigestible byproduct. Dating to the middle of the Cretaceous period, Jaelornis became the first fruit-eating bird that paleontologists had ever identified. Gymnosperm plants still live among us today as pine trees, cypresses, cycads, and ginkgos, and they remain just as indigestible as they were 300 million years ago. Instead, all of the plant products that we enjoy in our diets today belong to a different plant group, called angiosperms. More commonly known as flowering plants, they surround their seeds in fleshy ovaries that can become modified in a multitude of ways to encourage different styles of dispersion and germination. It is only these fleshy parts, in addition to other carbohydrate-rich modifications to help such plants survive, that humans can digest with ease. And angiosperms made their appearance surprisingly late in Earth's history, with the first fossil pollen from flowering plants discovered in rocks dating 140 million years ago to the early Cretaceous. But once on the scene, their superior means of reproduction allowed them to quickly rise to dominance. And just 20 million years later, as the Jaelornis fossils show, they had become an essential part of the food chain. And so this is where we find our time-traveling paleontologist, finally, at the end of their journey. The time machine sits empty and powered down, with only the current year showing on the dimmed and dusty screen. These are the latter years of the Mesozoic and the later years of the Great Age of Dinosaurs. The diverse landscape of forests and plains are punctuated by these terrible lizards in herds and as individuals, while primitive birds flit between the ground and the trees, diminutive mammals skittering between burrows in the dusty soil. The more dangerous theropod predators are cautious stalkers, sticking to the shadows, while crowds of hulking vegetarians like frilled triceratops and armored ankylosaurs all feast on the plant bounty of a mixed gymnosperm and angiosperm forest. And among them, a small human figure collects fruits and nuts from the ancestral flowering plants within their reach. They will be the perfect balanced complement to the Cretaceous meat and seafood that they have become adept at trapping and catching, and which wait for them in the basic shelter they have built among the ancient pine trees at the edge of the plain. This, finally, is a life that will sustain. After traveling through nearly 4 billion years of Earth's history, the paleontologist has found a place that they can truly survive and endure. They found water in the Archean and first encountered bearable temperatures in that great eon as well, although they learned never to take the long-term climate for granted. They were forced to travel 3.5 billion years into the Neo-Proterozoic before they found air they could breathe, and onwards another 0.5 billion to the Cambrian for a proper meal. Shelter only came in the Carboniferous after plants learned how to grow tall and strong, while a balanced diet with enough fiber and energy to keep them healthy could not be found until now, in the mid-Cretaceous. With just 100 million years separating them from their temporal origin, it is perhaps surprising that such survival could not be found sooner. Is it a result of the changeable face of our planet, or of the fragility and specialization of modern humans? Perhaps it is both. Nevertheless, this is it. 100 million years ago is the earliest in time a human could really survive, and the young settler, now neither a paleontologist or a traveler, intends to stay in this ancient paradise for as long as they can. You've been watching the entire history of the Earth. Don't forget to like and subscribe and leave a comment to tell us what you think. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.